Side 8. Christine. Continuing. On page 290. His voice rose to a thin scream in devilish harmony with the wind.
I don't need you, so fuck off.
He rushed around to the driver's side. His feet slid, and he grabbed for Christine. She was there, and he didn't fall. He got in. The engine revved. The headlights came on in a huge white glare, and the Fury pulled out, rear tires spinning up a fog of snow. Now the tears came fast and hard as she stood watching the taillights fade to round red periods and wink out as the car went around the corner. Her packages lay scattered at her feet. And then, suddenly, her mother was there, absurdly clothed in an open raincoat, green rubber boots, and her blue flannel nightgown. Honey, what's wrong? Nothing, Lee sobbed. I almost choked to death. I smelled something that might have come from a freshly opened tomb, and I think that somehow that car is alive, more alive every day. I think it's like some kind of horrible vampire, only it's taking Arnie's mind to feed itself, his mind and his spirit. Nothing's wrong. I had a fight with Arnie, that's all. Help me pick up my things, would you? They picked up Lee's parcels and went in. The door shut behind them, and the night belonged to the wind and to the swiftly falling snow. By morning, there would be better than 8 inches. Arnie cruised until sometime after midnight, and later had no memory of it. The snow had filled the streets. They were deserted and ghostly. It was not a night for the great American motor car. Nevertheless, Christine moved through the deepening storm with sure-footed ease, even without snow tires. Now and then, the prehistoric shape of a snowplow loomed and was gone. The radio played. It was WDIL all the way across the dial. The news came on. Eisenhower had predicted at the AFL-CIO convention a future of labor and management marching harmoniously into the future together. Dave Beck had denied that the Teamsters Union was a front for the rackets. Rock and roller Eddie Cochran had been killed in a car crash while en route to London's Heathrow Airport. 3 hours of emergency surgery had failed to save his life. The Russians were rattling their ICBMs. WDIL played the oldies all week long, but on the weekends they got really dedicated. 50s newscasts. Wow, that was... Never heard anything like that before. A really neat idea. That was totally insane. Pretty neat. The weather promised more snow. Then music again. Bobby Darin singing Splish Splash. Ernie Cado singing Mother-in-Law. The Kalin twins singing When. The Wipers beat time. He looked to his right, and Roland D. LeBay was riding shotgun. Roland D. LeBay sat there in his green pants and a faded shirt of army twill looking out of dark eye sockets. A beetle sat preening within one. You have to make them pay, Roland D. LeBay said. You have to make the shitters pay, Cunningham, every last fucking one of them. Yes, Arnie whispered. Christine hummed through the night, cutting the snow with fresh, sure tracks. Yes, that's a fact. And the Wipers nodded back and forth. 35. Now this brief interlude. Drive that old Chrysler to Mexico, boy. ZZ Top. At Libertyville High, Coach Puffer had given way to Coach Jones, and football had given way to basketball. But nothing really changed. The LHS Cagers didn't do much better than the LHS Gridiron Warriors. The only bright spot was Lenny Barong, a three-sport man whose major one was basketball. Lenny stubbornly went about having the great year he needed to have if he was going to get the athletic scholarship to Marquette that he lusted after. Sandy Galton suddenly blew town. One day he was there, the next he was gone. His mother, a 45-year-old wino who didn't look a day over 60, did not seem terribly concerned. Neither did his younger brother, who pushed more dope than any other kid in Gornick Junior High. A romantic rumor that he had cut out for Mexico made the rounds at Libertyville High. Another, less romantic rumor also made the rounds, that Buddy Repperton had been on Sandy about something, and he felt it would be safer to make himself scarce. The Christmas break approached, and the school's atmosphere grew restless and rather thundery, as it always did before a long vacation. The student body's overall grade average took its customary pre-Christmas dip. Book reports were turned in late, and often bore a suspicious resemblance to jacket copy. After all, how many sophomore English students are apt to call The Catcher in the Rye this burning classic of post-war adolescence? Class projects were left half-done or undone, the percentage of detention periods given for kissing and petting in the halls skyrocketed, and busts for marijuana went way up as the Libertyville High School students indulged in little pre-Christmas cheer. So a good many of the students were up. Teacher absenteeism was up. In the hallways and homerooms, Christmas decorations were up. Lee Cabot was not up. She flunked an exam for the first time in her high school career and got a D on an executive typing drill. She could not seem to study. She found her mind wandering back again and again to Christine, to the green dashboard instruments that had become hateful, gloating cat's eyes, watching her choke to death. But for most, the last week of school before the Christmas break was a mellow period when offenses, which would have earned detention slips at other times of the year, were excused, when hard-hearted teachers would sometimes actually throw a scale on an exam where everyone had done badly, when girls who had been bitter enemies made it up, and when boys who had scuffled repeatedly over real or imagined insults did the same. Perhaps more indicative of the mellow season than anything else was the fact that Miss Ratpack, the Gorgon of Room 23 Study Hall, was seen to smile, not just once, but several times. In the hospital, Dennis Gilder was moderately up. He had swapped his bedfast traction casts for walking casts. Physical therapy was no longer the torture it had been. He swung through corridors that had been strung with tinsel and decorated with first, second, and third grade Christmas pictures, his crutches thump-thumping along, sometimes in time to the carols spilling merrily from the overhead speakers. It was a caesura, a lull, an interlude, a period of quiet. During his seemingly endless walks up and down the hospital corridors, Dennis reflected that things could be worse, much, much worse. Before too long, they were. 36. Buddy and Christine. Well, it's out there in the distance, and it's creeping up on me. I ain't got no resistance, ain't nothing gonna set me free. Even a man with one eye could see something bad is gonna happen to me. The inmates. On Tuesday, December 12th, the Terriers lost to the Buccaneers, 54-48, in the Libertyville High gym. Most of the fans went out into the still black cold of the night, not too disappointed. Every sports writer in the Pittsburgh area had predicted another loss for the Terriers. The result could hardly be called an upset. And there was Lenny Barong for the Terrier fans to be proud of. He scored a mind-boggling 34 points all by himself, setting a new school record. Buddy Repperton, however, was disappointed. Because he was, Richie Trelawney was also at great pains to be disappointed, so was Bobby Stanton in the back seat. In the few months since he had been ushered out of LHS, Buddy seemed to have aged. Part of it was the beard. He looked less like Clint Eastwood, and more like some hard-drinking young actor's version of Captain Ahab. Buddy had been doing a lot of drinking these last few weeks. He had been having dreams so terrible he could barely remember them. He awoke sweaty and trembling, feeling he had barely escaped some awful doom that ran dark and quiet. The booze cut them off, though. Cut them right off at the fucking knees. Goddamn right. Working nights and sleeping days, that's all it was. He unrolled the window of his scuffed and dented Camaro, scooping in frigid air, and tossed out an empty bottle. He reached back over his shoulder and said, "Another Molotov cocktail, messieurs." "Right on, buddy," Bobby Stanton said respectfully, and slapped another bottle of Texas Driver into Buddy's hand. Buddy had treated them to a case of the stuff, enough to paralyze the entire Egyptian Navy, he said, after the game. He spun off the cap, steering momentarily with his elbows, and then gulped down half the bottle. He handed it to Richie and uttered a long, froggy belch. The Camaro's headlights cut Route 46, running northeast as straight as a string through rural Pennsylvania. Snow-covered fields lay dreaming on either side of the road, twinkling in a billion points of light that mimed the stars in the black winter sky. He was headed, in a sort of casual, half-drunk way, for Squatic Hills. Another destination might take his fancy in the meantime, but if not, the hills were a fine and private place to get high in peace. Richie passed the bottle back to Bobby again, who drank big, even though he hated the taste of Texas Driver. He supposed that when he got a little drunker, he wouldn't mind the taste at all. He might be hung over and puking tomorrow, but tomorrow was 1,000 years away. Bobby was still excited just to be with them. He was only a freshman, and Buddy Repperton, with his near-mythic reputation for bigness and badness, was a figure he viewed with mixed fear and awe. "Fucking clowns," Buddy said morosely. "What a bunch of fucking clowns. You call that a basketball game?" "All a bunch of retards," Richie agreed. Except for Barong, 34 points, not too tacky. I hate that fucking spade, Buddy said, giving Richie a long, measuring, drunken look. You taking up for that jungle bunny? No way, Buddy, Richie said promptly. Better not, I'll Barong him. Which do you want first? Bobby asked abruptly from the back seat. The good news or the bad news? Bad news first, Buddy said. He was into his third bottle of driver now and feeling no pain, only an aggrieved anger. He had forgotten, at least for the moment, that he had been expelled. He was concentrating only on the fact that the old school team, that bunch of fucking retard assholes, had let him down. Always bad news first. The Camaro rolled northeast at 65 over two-lane tar that was like a swipe of black paint across a hilly white floor. The land had begun to rise slightly as they approached Squatuk Hills. Well, the bad news is that a million Martians just landed in New York, Bobby said. Now you want to hear the good news? There is no good news, Buddy said in a low, morose, grieving voice. Richie would have liked to tell the kid you didn't try to cheer Buddy up when he was in a mood like this. That only made it worse. The thing to do was to let it run its course. Buddy had been this way ever since Moochie Welsh, that little four-eyed, panhandling dork, got run down by some psycho on JFK Drive. The good news is that they eat niggers and piss gasoline, Bobby said, and roared with laughter. He laughed for quite a while before he realized he was laughing alone. Then he shut up quickly. He glanced up and saw Buddy's bloodshot eyes looking at him over the uppermost tendrils of his beard, and that red, ferrety gaze floating in the rearview mirror gave him an unpleasant thrill of fear. It occurred to Bobby Stanton that he might have shut up a minute or two too late. Behind them, distant, perhaps as much as 3 miles back, headlights twinkled like insignificant yellow sparks in the night. You think that's funny? Buddy asked. You tell a fucking racist joke like that and you think it's funny? You're a fucking bigot, you know that? Bobby's mouth dropped open. But you said... I said I didn't like Barong. In general, I think spades are as good as white people. Buddy considered. Well, almost as good. But you want to watch out or you'll be walking home, Buddy snarled, with a rupture. Then you can write, I hate niggers all over your fucking truss. Oh, Bobby said in a small, scared voice. He felt as if he had reached up to turn on a light and had got a whopper of an electric shock. Sorry. Give me that bottle and shut your head. Bobby handed the driver up front with alacrity. His hand was shaking. But he killed the bottle. They passed a sign which read, Squatuk Hills State Park, 3 miles. The lake at the center of the state park was a popular beach area in the summertime, but the park was closed from November to April. The road, which wound through the park to Squatuk Lake, was kept plowed for periodic National Guard maneuvers and winter explorer scouts camping trips, however, and Buddy had discovered a side entrance which went around the main gate and then joined the park road. Buddy liked to go into the silent, wintry state park and cruise and drink. Behind them, the distant twin sparks had grown to circles, dual headlights about a mile back. Hand me up another Molotov cocktail, you fucking racist pig. Bobby handed up a fresh bottle of driver, remaining prudently silent. Buddy drank deeply, belched, and then handed the bottle across to Richie. No thanks, man. You drink it or you may find yourself getting an enema with it. Sure, okay, Richie said, wishing mightily that he had stayed home tonight. He drank. The Camaro sped along, its headlights cutting the night. Buddy glanced into the rear view and saw the other car. It was now coming up fast. He glanced at his speedometer and saw he was doing 65. The car behind them had to be doing close to 70. Buddy felt something, a curious kind of doubling back to the dreams he could not quite remember. A cold finger seemed to press lightly against his heart. Ahead, the road branched in two, Route 46 continuing east toward New Stanton, the other road bearing north toward Squatuk Hills State Park. A large orange sign advised closed winter months. Barely slowing, Buddy dragged left and shot up the hill. The approach road to the park was not so well plowed, and overarching trees had kept the warm afternoon sun from melting off the snowpack. The Camaro slid a little before grabbing the road again. In the back seat, Bobby Stanton made a low, uneasy sound. Buddy looked up in the rear view, expecting to see the other car shoot by along 46. After all, there was nothing up this road but a dead end as far as most drivers were concerned. But instead, it took the turn even faster than Buddy had and pounded along after them, now less than a quarter of a mile behind. Its headlights were four glowing white circles that washed the Camaro's interior. Bobby and Richie turned around to look. "What the fuck?" Richie muttered. But Buddy knew. Suddenly, he knew. It was the car that had run down Moochie. Oh, yes, it was. The psycho who had greased Moochie was behind the wheel of that car, and now he was after Buddy. He stepped down on the gope, and the Camaro started to fly. The speedometer needle crept up to 70, and then gradually heeled over toward 80. Trees blurred past, dark sketches in the night. The lights behind them did not fall back. The truth was that they were still gaining. The duels had merged into two great white eyes. "Man, you want to slow down," Richie said. He grabbed for his seatbelt, actively scared now. "If we roll at this speed..." Buddy didn't answer. He hunched over the wheel, alternating glances at the road ahead, with glances shot into the rearview mirror, where those lights grew and grew. "The road curves up ahead," Bobby said hoarsely, and as the curve approached, guardrail reflectors flickering chrome in the Camaro's headlights, he screamed at Buddy, "It curves, it curves!" Buddy changed down to second gear, and the Camaro's engine bellowed its protest. The tachometer needle hit 6,000 RPM, danced briefly at redline 7,000, and then dropped back into a more normal range. Backfires blatted through the Camaro's straight pipes like machine gun fire. Buddy pulled the wheel over, and the car floated into the sharp bend. The rear wheel skimmed over hard-packed snow. At the last possible instant, he shifted back up, tramped on the accelerator pedal, and let his body sway freely as the Camaro's left rear end slammed into the snowbank, digging a coffin-sized divot, and then bouncing off. The Camaro slewed the other way. He went with it, then goosed the accelerator again. For one moment, he thought it would not respond, that the skid would continue, and they would simply barrel sideways up the road at 75 until they hit a bear patch and flipped over. But the Camaro straightened out. "Holy Jesus, Buddy, slow down!" Richie wailed. Buddy hung over the wheel, grinning through his beard, bloodshot eyes bulging. The bottle of driver was clamped between his legs. "There, there, you crazy murdering son of a bitch. Let's see you do that without rolling it over." A moment later, the headlights reappeared closer than ever. Buddy's grin faltered and faded. For the first time, he felt a sickish, unmanning tingle running up his legs toward his crotch. Fear, real fear, stole into him. Bobby had been looking behind as the car chasing them rounded the bend, and now he turned around, his face slack and cheesy. "It didn't even skid," he said.
"But that's impossible. That's..."
"Buddy, who is it?" Richie asked. He reached out to touch Buddy's elbow, and his hand was flung away with such force that his knuckles cracked on the glass of his window. "You don't want to touch me," Buddy whispered. The road unrolled straight in front of him, not black tar now, but white snow, packed and treacherous. The Camaro was rolling over this greasy surface at better than 90 miles an hour. Only its roof and the orange ping-pong ball jammed on top of its radio aerial, visible between chest-high embankments. "You don't want to touch me, Richie. Not going this fast."
"Is it?"
Richie's voice cracked and he couldn't go on. Buddy spared him a glance, and at the sight of the fear in Buddy's small red eyes, Richie's own terror came up in his throat like hot smooth oil.
"Yeah," Buddy said. "I think it is."
No houses up here. They were already on state land. Nothing up here but the high snow embankments and the dark interlacing of trees.
"It's going to bump us,"
Bobby screeched from the back seat. His voice was as high as an old woman's. Between his feet, the remaining bottles of Texas Driver chattered wildly in their carton.
"Buddy, it's going to bump us."
The car behind them had come to within 5 feet of the Camaro's back bumper. Its high beams flooded the car with light bright enough to read fine print. It slipped forward even closer. A moment later, there was a thud. The Camaro shifted its stance on the road as the car behind them fell back a trifle. To Buddy, it was as if they were suddenly floating, and he knew they were a hair's breadth from going into a wild, looping skid, the front end and the rear briskly swapping places until they hit something and rolled. A droplet of sweat, as warm and stinging as a tear, ran into his eye. Gradually, the Camaro straightened out again. When he felt that he had control, Buddy let his right foot smoothly depress the accelerator all the way. If it was Cunningham in that old rust bucket 58, and hadn't that been part of the dreams he could barely remember, the Camaro would shut him down. The engine was now screaming. The tach needle was again on the edge of the red line at 7,000 RPM. The speedometer had passed the 100 post, and the snowbank streamed past them on either side in ghastly silence. The road ahead looked like a point-of-view shot in a film that had been insanely speeded up.
"Oh, dear God!" Bobby babbled. "Oh, dear God, please don't let me get killed. Oh, dear God, oh, holy shit."
"He wasn't there the night we trashed Cuntface's car," Buddy thought. "He doesn't know what's going on. Poor busted luck son of a whore."
He did not really feel sorry for Bobby, but if he could have been sorry for anyone, it would have been for the little shit-for-brains freshman. On his right, Richie Trelawney sat bolt upright and as pallid as a gravestone, his eyes eating up his face. Richie knew the score, all right. The car whispered toward them, headlights swelling in the rearview mirror. He can't be gaining, Buddy's mind screamed. He can't be. But the car behind them was indeed gaining, and Buddy sensed it was boring in for the kill. His mind ran like a rat in a cage looking for a way out, and there was none. The slot in the left snowbank that marked the little side road he usually used to bypass the gate and get into the state park had already flashed by. He was running out of time, room, and options. There was another soft bump, and again the Camaro slewed, this time at something over 110 miles an hour. No hope, man, Buddy thought fatalistically. He took his hands off the wheel altogether and grabbed his seatbelt. For the first time in his life, he snapped it shut across his waist. At the same time, Bobby Stanton in the back seat screamed in a shrill ecstasy of fear,
"The gate, man! Oh, Jesus, Buddy, it's the gate!"
The Camaro had breasted a final steep hill. The far side sloped down to a place where the road branched in two, becoming the ingress and egress from the state park. Between the two ways stood a small gatehouse on a concrete island. In the summertime, a lady sat in there on a camp chair and took a buck from each car that entered the park. Now the gatehouse was flooded with ghastly light as the two cars raced down toward it, the Camaro heeling steadily to port as the skid worsened.
"Fuck you, cuntface!" Buddy screamed. "Fuck you and the horse you rode in on!"
He yanked the wheel all the way around, twirling it with the death knob that held one bobbing red dye in alcohol. Bobby screamed again. Richie Trelawney clapped his hands over his face, his last thought on earth, a constant repetition of, "Watch out for broken glass, watch out for broken glass, watch out for broken glass." The Camaro swapped ends, and now the headlights of the car following blared directly into them, and Buddy began to scream because it was Cuntface's car, all right. That grill was impossible to mistake. It seemed at least a mile wide, only there was no one behind the wheel. The car was totally empty. In the last 2 seconds before impact, Christine's headlights shifted away to what was now Buddy's left. The Fury shot into the ingress roadway as neatly and exactly as a bullet shoots down a rifle barrel. It snapped off the wooden barrier and sent it flying end over end into the black night, round yellow reflectors flashing. Buddy Repperton's Camaro rammed ass backwards into the concrete island where the gatehouse stood. The 8-inch concrete lip peeled off everything bolted to the lower deck, leaving the twisted wreckage of the straight pipes and the muffler sitting on the snow like some weird sculpture. The Camaro's rear end was first accordioned and then demolished. Bobby Stanton was demolished along with it. Buddy was dimly aware of something hitting his back like a bucket of warm water. It was Bobby Stanton's blood. The Camaro flipped into the air end for end, a mangled projectile in a squall of flying splinters and shattered boards, one headlight still glaring maniacally. It did a complete 360 and came down with a glass jangling thud and rolled over. The firewall ruptured, and the engine slid backward at an angle, crushing Richie Trelawney from the waist down. There was a coughing explosion of fire from the ruptured gas tank as the Camaro came to rest. Buddy Repperton was alive. He had been cut in several places by flying glass. One ear had been clipped off with surgical neatness, leaving a red hole on the left side of his head. And his leg had been broken, but he was alive. His seat belt had saved him. He thumbed the catch and it let go. The crackle of fire was like someone crumpling paper. He could feel the baking heat. He tried to open the door, but the door was crimped shut. Panting hoarsely, he threw himself through the empty space where the windshield had been, and there was Christine. She stood 40 yards away, facing him at the end of a long, slewing skid mark. The rumble of her engine was like the slow panting of some gigantic animal. Buddy licked his lips. Something in his left side pulled and jabbed with every breath. Something busted in there, too, ribs. Christine's engine gunned and fell off. Faintly, like something from a lunatic's nightmare, he could hear Elvis Presley singing Jailhouse Rock. Orange-pink points of light on the snow. The rumbling whoosh of fire. It was going to blow. It did blow. The Camaro's gas tank went with a hard thudding noise. Buddy felt a rude hand shove him in the back. And he flew through the air and landed in the snow on his hurt side. His jacket was flaming. He grunted and rolled in the snow, putting himself out. Then he tried to get to his knees. Behind him, the Camaro was a blazing pyre in the night. Christine's engine revving and falling off, now more quickly, more urgently.
Buddy finally managed to get to his hands and knees. He peered at Cunningham's Plymouth through the sweaty tangles of hair hanging in his eyes. The hood had been crimped up when the Plymouth blasted through the barrier arm, and the radiator was dripping a mixture of water and antifreeze that steamed on the snow like fresh animal spoor. Buddy licked his lips again. They felt as dry as lizard skin. His back felt warm, as if he had gotten a moderately bad sunburn. He could smell smoking cloth, but in the extremity of his shock he was unaware that both his parka and the two shirts beneath had been burned away. "Listen," he said, hardly aware he was speaking. "Listen, hey." Christine's engine screamed, and she came at him, rear end flirting back and forth as her tires spun through the sugary snow. The crimped hood was like a mouth in a frozen snarl. Buddy waited on his hands and knees, resisting the overpowering urge to leap and scramble away at once, resisting, as much as he could, the wild panic that was ripping away his self-control. No one in the car. A more imaginative person would already have gone mad, perhaps. At the last possible second, he rolled to the left, screaming as the splintered ends of the broken bone in his leg ground together. He felt something bullet past him, inches away. There was warm, foul-smelling exhaust in his face for a moment, and then the snow was red as Christine's taillights flashed. She wheeled, skidding, and came back at him. "No!" Buddy screamed. Pain lanced at his chest. "No, no, no!" He leaped, blind reflexes taking over, and this time the bullet was closer, clipping leather off one shoe and turning his left foot instantly numb. He turned crazily on his hands and knees like a small child playing eyewitness at a birthday party. Blood from his mouth now mixed with the snot running freely from his nose. One of his broken ribs had nicked a lung. Blood ran down his cheek from the hole in his head where his ear had been. Frosty air jetted from his nose. His breath came in whistling sobs. Christine paused. White vapor drifted from her tailpipe. Her engine throbbed and purred. The windshield was a black blank. Behind Buddy, the remains of the Camaro shot greasy flames at the sky. A razor-sharp wind fluttered and fanned them. Bobby Stanton sat in the inferno of the back seat, his head cocked, a grin locked onto his blackening face. "Playing with me," Buddy thought. "Playing with me, that's what it's doing, like a cat with a mouse." "Please," he croaked. The headlights were blinding, turning the blood dripping down his cheek and from the sides of his mouth to an insectile black. "Please, I'll tell him I'm sorry. I'll crawl to him on my fucking hands and knees if that's what you want, only please, The engine screamed. Christine leaped at him like old Doom from a dark age. Buddy howled and lunged aside again, and this time the bumper struck his shin and broke his other leg and threw him toward the embankment at the side of the park road. He hit and sprawled like a loose bag of grain. Christine wheeled back toward him. But Buddy had seen a chance, one thin chance. He began to scramble wildly up the embankment, digging into the snow with bare hands from which the feeling had already departed, digging with his feet, ignoring the tremendous clouts of pain from his shattered legs. Now his breath came in little screams as the headlights grew brighter and the engine louder. Every clod of snow threw its own jagged black shadow, and he could feel it. He could feel it behind him like some horrible man-eating tiger. There was a crunch and jangle of metal, and Buddy cried out as one of his feet was driven into the snow by Christine's bumper. He yanked it out of the snow, leaving his shoe wedged deep. Laughing, gibbering, crying, Buddy gained the top of the bank thrown up by some National Guard motor pool plow days ago, tottered on the edge of balance there, pinwheeled his arms, and barely kept from rolling back down. He turned to face Christine. The Plymouth had reversed across the road and now came forward again, rear tire spinning, digging at the snow. It crashed into the bank a foot below where Buddy was perched, making him sway and sending down a minor avalanche of snow. The hit crimped her hood in further, but Buddy was not touched. She reversed again through a mist of churned-up snow, engine now seeming to howl with frustrated anger. Buddy screamed in triumph and shook his middle finger at her. "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you!" A spray of mixed blood and spittle flew from his lips. With each gasping breath, the pain seemed to sink deeper into his left side, numbing and paralyzing. Christine roared forward and slammed into the embankment again. This time, a large section of the bank, loosened in the car's first charge, came sliding down, burying Christine's wrinkled, snarling snout, and Buddy almost came down with it. He saved himself only by skittering backward rapidly, sliding on his butt and pulling himself with hands that were clawed into the snow like bloody grappling hooks. His legs were in agony now, and he flopped over on his side, gasping like a beached fish. Christine came again. "Get out of here!" Buddy cried. "Get out of here, you crazy whore!" She slammed into the embankment again, and this time enough snow fell to douse her hood to the windshield. The wipers came on and began to arc back and forth, flicking melting snow away. She reversed again, and Buddy saw that one more hit would send him cascading down onto Christine's hood with the snow. He let himself fall over backward and went rolling down the far side of the embankment, screaming each time his broken ribs bumped the ground. He came to rest in loose powder, staring up at the black sky, the cold stars. His teeth began to click helplessly together. Shudders raced through his body. Christine didn't come again, but he could hear the soft mutter of her engine, not coming, but waiting. He glanced at the snowbank bulking against the sky. Beyond it, the glow of the burning Camaro had begun to wane a bit. How long it had been since the crash, he didn't know. Would anyone see the fire and come to rescue him? He didn't know that either. Buddy became aware of two things simultaneously, that blood was flowing from his mouth, flowing at a frightening rate, and that he was very cold. He would freeze to death if someone didn't come. Frightened all over again, he struggled and thrashed his way into a sitting position. He was trying to decide if he could worm his way back up and watch the car. It was worse not being able to see it. When he glanced up at the embankment again, his breath snagged and stopped. A man was standing there. Only it wasn't a man at all. It was a corpse. A rotting corpse in green pants. It was shirtless, but a back brace, splotched with gray mold, was cinched around its blackening torso. White bone gleamed through the skin stretched across its face. "That's it for you, you shitter," this starlit apparition whispered. The last of Buddy's control broke, and he began to scream hysterically, his eyes bulging, his long hair seeming to puff into a grotesque helmet around his bloody, soot-smudged face, as the root of each strand stiffened and stood on end. Blood poured from his mouth in freshets and drenched the collar of his parka. He tried to skid backward, hooking into the snow with his hands again, and sliding his buttocks as the thing came toward him. It had no eyes. Its eyes were gone, eaten out of its face by God knew what squirming things. And he could smell it. Oh, God, he could smell it, and the smell was like rotting tomatoes. The smell was death. The corpse of Roland D. LeBay held out its decayed hands to Buddy Repperton and grinned. Buddy screamed. Buddy howled, and suddenly he stiffened, his lips forming an O of perfect finality, puckered as if he wished to kiss the horror shambling toward him. His hands scratched and scrabbled at the left side of his shredded parka above his heart, which had finally been punctured by the jagged stub of a splintered rib. He fell backward, feet kicking grooves in the snow, his final breath slipping out in a long white jet from his slack mouth, like auto exhaust. On the embankment, the thing he had seen flickered and was gone. There were no tracks. From the far side, Christine's engine cranked up into an exhaust-crackling bellow of triumph that struck the frowning, snow-covered uplands of Squantic Hills, and then echoed back. On the far verge of Squantic Lake, some 10 miles away as the crow flies, a young man who had gone out for a cross-country ski by starlight heard the sound and suddenly stopped, his hands on his poles and his head cocked. Abruptly, the skin on his back prickled into bumps, as if a goose had just walked over his grave. And although he knew it was only a car somewhere on the other side, sound carried a long way up here on still winter nights, his first thought was that something prehistoric had awakened and had tracked its prey to earth, a great wolf or perhaps a saber-toothed tiger. The sound was not repeated, and he went on his way. 37. Darnell cogitates. "Baby, let me ride in your automobile. Hey, babe, let me ride in your automobile. Tell me, sweet baby, tell me, just how do you feel?" Chester Burnett. Will Darnell was at the garage until after midnight, on the night Buddy Repperton and his friends met Christine in Squantic Hills. His emphysema had been particularly bad that day. When it got bad, he was afraid to lie down, although he was ordinarily a perfect bear for sleep. The doctor told him it was not at all likely that he would choke to death in his sleep. But as he grew older, and the emphysema slowly tightened its grip on his lungs, he feared it more and more. The fact that his fear was irrational didn't change it in the least. Although he hadn't been inside a church of any faith since he had been 12 years old, 49 years ago now, he had been morbidly interested in the circumstances surrounding the death of Pope John Paul I 10 weeks before. John Paul had died in bed and had been found there in the morning, already stiffening, probably. That was the part that haunted Will. Already stiffening, probably. He pulled into the garage at 9:30, driving his 1966 Chrysler Imperial, the last car he intended to ever own. At about the same time, Buddy Repperton was noticing the twin sparks of distant headlights in his rearview mirror. Will was worth better than $2 million, but money didn't give him much pleasure anymore, if indeed it ever had. The money didn't even seem completely real anymore. Nothing did, except the emphysema. That was hideously real. And Will welcomed anything that took his mind off it. The problem of Arnie Cunningham, now. That had taken his mind off his emphysema. He supposed that was why he had let Cunningham hang around the place, when all of his strongest instincts told him to get the kid out of the garage. He was in some way dangerous. Something was going on with Cunningham and his rebuilt 58. Something very peculiar. The kid wasn't in tonight. He and the entire LHS chess club were in Philadelphia for 3 days at the Northern States Fall Tourney. Cunningham had laughed about that. He was much changed from the pimply, big-eyed kid that Buddy Repperton had jumped on. The kid Will had immediately and erroneously dismissed as a crybaby jellyfish and maybe a goddamn queer in the bargain. For one thing, he had grown cynical. He had told Will in the office yesterday afternoon over cigars. The boy had developed a taste for those as well. Will doubted if his parents knew. That he had missed so many chess club meetings that according to the bylaws, he was no longer a member. Slauson, the faculty advisor, knew it, but was conveniently overlooking it until after the Northern States tourney. I've missed more meetings than anyone, but I also happen to play better than anyone else, and the shitter knows. Arnie winced and shoved both hands into the small of his back for a moment. You ought to get a doctor to look at that, Will remarked. Arnie winked, suddenly looking much older than nearly 18. I don't need anything but a good Christian fuck to stretch the vertebrae. So you're going to Philly. Will had been disappointed, even though Cunningham had the off time coming. It meant he would have to put Jimmy Sykes in charge for the next couple of nights, and Jimmy didn't know his ass from ice cream. Sure, I'm not about to turn down 3 days of bright lights, Arnie said. He saw Will's sour face and had grinned. Don't worry, man. This close to Christmas, all your regulars are buying toys for the kiddies instead of spark plugs and carburetor kits. This place will be dead until next year, and you know it. That was certainly true enough, but he hadn't needed a snot-nosed kid to point it out for him. You want to go to Albany for me after you get back? Will had asked. Arnie looked at him carefully. When? This weekend. Saturday? Yes. What's the deal? You take my Chrysler to Albany, that's the fucking deal. Henry Buck has 14 clean used cars he wants to get rid of. He says they're clean. You go look at them. I give you a blank check. If they look good, you make the deal. If they look hot, tell them to take a flying fuck at a rolling donut. And what do I take with me? Will had looked at him for a long time. Getting scared, Cunningham? No. Arnie crushed his cigar out, half-smoked. He looked at Will defensively. Maybe I just feel the odds getting a little longer each time I do it. Is it coke? I get Jimmy to do it, Will said brusquely. Just tell me what it is. 200 cartons of Winston's. All right. You sure? Just like that? Arnie had laughed. It'll be a break from chess. Will parked the Chrysler in the stall closest to his office, the one with Mr. Darnell, Do Not Block, painted inside the lines. He got out and slammed the door, puffing, laboring for breath. The emphysema was sitting on his chest, and tonight it seemed to have brought its brother. No, he just wasn't going to lie down, no matter what that asshole doctor said. Jimmy Sykes was apathetically wielding the big push broom. Jimmy was tall and gangling, 25 years old. His light mental retardation made him look perhaps 8 years younger. He had started combing his hair back in a 50s-style ducktail in imitation of Cunningham, whom Jimmy almost worshipped, except for the low whoosh, whoosh of the broom's bristles on the oil-stained concrete
The place was silent and empty.
"Place is really jumping tonight, Jimmy, huh?" Will wheezed. Jimmy looked around.
"No, sir, Mr. Darnell. Nobody been in since Mr. Hatch came and got his fare lane, and that was half an hour ago."
"Just joking," Will said, wishing again that Cunningham were here. "You couldn't talk to Jimmy except on a perfectly literal Dick and Jane level. Still, maybe he would invite him in for a cup of coffee with a slug of Courvoisier tipped in for good measure. Make it a threesome. Him, Jimmy, and the emphysema. Or maybe, since the emphysema had brought its brother tonight, you'd have to call it a foursome. What do you say about..." He broke off suddenly, noticing that stall 20 was empty. Christine was gone. "Arnie came in," he said.
"Arnie?"
Jimmy repeated, blinking stupidly. Arnie Cunningham," Will said impatiently. "How many Arnies do you know? His car's gone." Jimmy looked around at stall 20 and frowned.
"Oh, yeah."
Will smiled. "Hotshot got knocked out of his hotshot chess tournament, huh?"
"Oh, did he?"
Jimmy asked.
"Geez, that's too bad, huh?"
Will restrained an urge to grab Jimmy and give him a shake and a wallop. He would not get angry. That only made it harder to breathe, and he would end up having to shoot his lungs full of the horrible-tasting stuff from his aspirator. "Well, what did he say, Jimmy? What did he say when you saw him?"
But Will knew, suddenly and surely, that Jimmy hadn't seen Arnie. Jimmy finally understood what Will was driving at. "Oh, I didn't see him. Just saw Christine go out the door, you know. Boy, that's some pretty car, ain't it? He fixed it up like magic."
"Yes," Will said. "Like magic." It was a word that had occurred to him in connection with Christine before. He suddenly changed his mind about inviting Jimmy in for coffee and brandy. Still looking at stall 20, he said, "You can go home now, Jimmy."
"Oh, geez, Mr. Darnell. You said I could have 6 hours tonight. That ain't over until 10.
I'll punch you out at 10. Jimmy's muddy eyes brightened at this unexpected, almost unheard-of largesse.
"Really?"
"Yeah, really, really. Make like a tree and leave, Jimmy, okay?"
"Sure," Jimmy said,
thinking that for the first time in the 5 or 6 years he had worked for Will, he had trouble remembering which it was, although his mother kept track of it, the same as she kept track of all his tax papers. The old grouch had gotten the Christmas spirit, just like in that movie about the three ghosts. Summoning up his own Christmas spirit, Jimmy cried, "That's a big 10-4, good buddy." Will winced and lumbered into his office. He turned on the Mr. Coffee and sat down behind his desk, watching as Jimmy put away his broom, turned out most of the overhead fluorescents, and got his heavy coat. Will leaned back and thought. It was, after all, his brains that had kept him alive all these years, alive and one step ahead. He had never been handsome. He had been fat all of his adult life, and his health had always been terrible. A childhood bout of scarlatina one spring had been followed by a mild case of polio. He had been left with a right arm that operated at only about 70% capacity. As a young man, he had endured a plague of boils. When Will was 43, his doctor had discovered a large spongy growth under one arm. It had turned out to be non-malignant, but the removal surgery had kept him on his back most of one summer, and as a result, he had developed bed sores. A year later, he had almost died of double pneumonia. Now it was incipient diabetes and emphysema. But his brains had always been fine and dandy, and his brains kept him one step ahead. So he leaned back and thought about Arnie. He supposed one of the things that had favorably impressed him about Cunningham after he had stood up to Repperton that day was a certain similarity to the long-ago teenaged Will Darnell. Of course, Cunningham wasn't sickly, but he had been pimply, disliked, a loner. Those things had all been true of the young Will Darnell. Cunningham had brains, too. Brains and that car, that strange car. "Good night, Mr. Darnell," Jimmy called. He stood by the door for a moment and then added, uncertainly,
"Merry Christmas."
Will raised his hand in a wave. Jimmy left. Will heaved his bulk out of his chair, got the bottle of Courvoisier out of the filing cabinet, and set it down next to the Mr. Coffee. Then he sat down again,
A rough chronology was ticking through his mind. August. Cunningham brings in an old wreck of a 58 Plymouth and parks it in stall 20. It looks familiar, and it should. It's Raleigh LeBay's Plymouth. And Arnie doesn't know it. He has no need to know it. But once upon a time, Raleigh LeBay also made an occasional run to Albany, or Burlington, or Portsmouth, for Will Darnell. Only in those dim dead days, Will had a 54 Cadillac. Different transport cars, same false-bottom trunk with a hidden compartment for fireworks, cigarettes, booze, and pot. In those days, Will had never heard of cocaine. He supposed no one but jazz musicians in New York had. Late August. Repperton and Cunningham get into it, and Darnell kicks Repperton out. He's tired of Repperton, the constant braggadocio, the cock-of-the-walk manner. He's hurting custom, and while he'll make all the runs into New York and New England that Will wants, he's careless, and carelessness is dangerous. He has a tendency to exceed the double-nickel speed limit. He's gotten speeding tickets. All it would take is one nosy cop to put them all in court. Darnell isn't afraid of going to jail, not in Libertyville, but it would look bad. There was a time when he didn't care much how things looked, but he's older now. Will got up, poured coffee, and tipped in a capful of brandy. He paused, thought it over, and tipped in a second capful. He sat down, took a cigar out of his breast pocket, looked at it, and lit it. Fuck you, emphysema, take this. Fragrant smoke rising around him, good hot coffee laced with brandy before him, Darnell stared out into his shadowy, silent garage and thought some more. September. The kid asks him to jump an inspection sticker and loan him a Dieter plate so he can take his girl to a football game. Darnell does it. Hell, there was a day when he used to sell an inspection sticker for $7 and never even look at the car it was going on. Besides, the kid's car is looking good. A little rough, maybe, but it's still more than a little noisy. But all in all, pretty damn good. He's doing a real job of restoration. And that's pretty damn strange, isn't it? When you consider that no one has ever seen him really work on it. Oh, little things, sure. Replacing bulbs in the parking lights. Changing tires. The kid is no dummy about cars. Will sat right in this chair one day and watched him replace the upholstery in the back seat. But no one has seen him working on the car's exhaust system, which was totally shot when he wheeled the 58 in here for the first time late last summer. And no one has seen him doing any body work, either. Although the Fury's bod, which had an advanced case of cancer when the kid brought it in, now looks cherry. Darnell knew what Jimmy Sykes thought, because he had asked him once. Jimmy thought Arnie did the serious work at night after everyone was gone. "That's one hell of a lot of night work," Darnell said aloud, and felt a sudden chill that not even the brandy-laced coffee could dispel. A lot of night work, yeah, it must have been. Because what the kid seemed to be doing days was listening to the greaser music on WDIL. That and a lot of aimless fooling around. "I guess he does the big stuff at night," Jimmy had said, with all the guileless faith of a child explaining how Santa Claus gets down the chimney or how the Tooth Fairy put the quarter under his pillow. Will didn't believe in either Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, and he didn't believe that Arnie had restored Christine at night, either. Two other facts rolled around uneasily in his mind, like pool balls looking for a pocket in which to come to rest. He knew that Cunningham had been driving the car around out back a lot, before it was street legal. That was one thing. Just cruising slowly up and down the narrow lanes between the thousands of junked cars in the block-long back lot. Driving at 5 miles an hour, around and around after dark, after everyone had gone home. Circling the big crane with the round electromagnet and the great box of the car crusher. Cruising. The one time Darnell asked him about it, Arnie had told him he was checking out a shimmy in the front end. But the kid couldn't lie for shit. No one ever checked out a shimmy at 5 miles an hour. That was what Cunningham did after everyone else went home. That had been his night work. Cruising out back, threading his way in and out of the junkers, headlights flickering unsteadily in their rust-eaten sockets. Then there was the Plymouth's odometer. It ran backward. Cunningham had pointed that out to him with a sly little smile. It ran backward at an extremely fast rate. He told Will that he figured the odometer turned back 5 miles or so for every actual mile traveled. Will had been frankly amazed. He had heard of setting odometers back in the used car business, and he had done a good bit of it himself, along with stuffing transmissions full of sawdust to stifle their death whines, and pouring boxes of oatmeal into terminally ill radiators to temporarily plug their leaks. But he had never seen one that ran backwards spontaneously. He would have thought it impossible. Arnie had just smiled a funny little smile and called it a glitch. It was a glitch, all right, Will thought. One hell of a glitch. The two thoughts clicked lazily off each other and rolled in different directions. Boy, that's some pretty car, isn't it? He fixed it up like magic. Will didn't believe in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, but he was perfectly willing to acknowledge that there were strange things in the world. A practical man recognized that and put it to use if he could. A friend of Will's who lived in Los Angeles claimed he had seen the ghost of his wife before the big quake of 67, and Will had no particular reason to doubt the claim, although he would have doubted it completely if the friend had had anything to gain. Quint Youngerman, another friend, had claimed to have seen his father, long dead, standing at the foot of his hospital bed after Quint, a steelworker, had taken a terrible fall from the fourth floor of a building under construction down on Wood Street. Will had heard such stories off and on all his life, as most people undoubtedly did. And as most thinking people probably did, he put them in a kind of open file, neither believing nor disbelieving, unless the teller was an obvious crank. He put them in that open file because no one knew where people came from when they were born, and no one knew where people went when they died. And not all the Unitarian ministers and born-again Jesus shouters and popes and Scientologists in the world could convince Will otherwise. Just because some people went crazy on the subject didn't mean they knew anything. He put stuff like that in that open file because nothing really inexplicable had ever happened to him. Except maybe something like that was happening now. November. Repperton and his good buddies beat the living shit out of Cunningham's car at the airport. When it comes in on the tow truck, it looks like the green giant shat all over it. Darnell looks at it and thinks it's never going to run again. That's all, it's never going to run another foot. At the end of the month, the Welch kid gets killed on JFK Drive. December. A state police detective comes sucking around. Junkins. He comes sucking around one day and talks to Cunningham. Then he comes sucking around on a day when Cunningham isn't here and wants to know how come the kid is lying about how much damage Repperton and his dog-turd friends, of whom the late and unlamented Peter Moochie Welch was one, did to Cunningham's Plymouth. "Why are you talking to me?" Darnell asks him, wheezing and coughing through a cloud of cigar smoke. "Talk to him. It's his fucking Plymouth, not mine. I just run this place so working Joes can keep their cars running and keep putting food on the table for their families." Junkins listens patiently to this rap. He knows Will Darnell is doing a hell of a lot more than just running a do-it-yourself garage in a junkyard, but Darnell knows he knows, so that's okay. Junkins lights a cigarette and says, "I'm talking to you because I already talked to the kid and he won't tell me. For a little while there I thought he wanted to tell me. I got the feeling he's scared green about something. Then he tightened up and wouldn't tell me squat." Darnell says, "If you think Arnie ran down that Welch kid, say so." Junkins says, "I don't. His parents say he was home asleep, and it doesn't feel like they're lying to cover up for him. But Welch was one of the guys that trashed his car, we're pretty sure of that. And I'm positive he's lying about how bad they trashed it, and I don't know why, and it's driving me crazy." "Too bad," Darnell says, with no sympathy at all. Junkins asks, "How bad was it, Mr. Darnell? You tell me." And Darnell tells his first and only lie during the interview with Junkins. "I really didn't notice." He noticed, all right. And he knows why Arnie is lying about it, trying to minimize it. And this cop would know why, too, if it wasn't so obvious he was walking all over it instead of seeing it. Cunningham is lying because the damage was horrible. The damage was much worse than this state gumshoe can imagine. Those hoods didn't just beat up on Cunningham's 58, they killed it. Cunningham is lying because, although nobody saw him do much of anything during the week after the tow truck brought Christine back to stall 20, the car was basically as good as new, even better than it had been before. Cunningham lied to the cop because the truth was incredible. Incredible, Darnell said out loud, and drank the rest of his coffee. He looked down at the telephone, reached for it, and then drew his hand back. He had a call to make, but it might be better to finish thinking this through first, have all his ducks in a row. He himself was the only one, other than Cunningham himself, who could appreciate the incredibility of what had happened. The car's complete and total regeneration. Jimmy was too soft in the attic, and the other guys were in and out, not regular custom at all. Still, there had been comments about what a fantastic job Cunningham had done. A lot of the guys who had been doing repairs on their rolling iron during that week in November had used the word incredible, and several of them had looked uneasy. John A. Pomberton, who bought and sold used trucks, had been trying to get an old dumpster he'd picked up in running shape that week. Johnny knew cars and trucks better than anyone else in Libertyville, maybe anyone else in all of Pennsylvania. He told Will frankly and flat out that he couldn't believe it. "It's like voodoo," Johnny Pomberton had said, and then uttered a laugh without much humor. Will only sat there looking politely interested, and after a second or two, the old man shook his head and went away. Sitting in his office and looking out at the garage, eerily silent in the slack time that came every year in the weeks before Christmas, Will thought, not for the first time, that most people would accept anything if they saw it happen right before their very eyes. In a very real sense, there was no supernatural, no abnormal. What happened, happened, and that was the end. Jimmy Sykes. Like magic. Junkins. He's lying about it, but I'll be goddamned if I know why. Will pulled open his desk drawer, denting his paunch, and found his noteminder book for 1978. He paged through it and found his own scrawled entry. Cunningham, Chess Turney, Philly Sheraton, December 11th to 13th. He called directory assistance, got the number of the hotel, and made the call. He was not too surprised to feel his heartbeat shifting into a higher gear as the phone rang, and the desk clerk picked it up. Like magic. "Hello, Philadelphia Sheraton." "Hello," Will said. "You have a chess tournament put up there, Northeastern States, yes, sir," the desk clerk broke in. He sounded quick and almost insufferably young. "I'm calling from Libertyville, P.A., Will said. "I believe you have an LHS student named Arnold Cunningham registered. He's one of the chess tourney kids. I'd like to speak to him if he's in."
"Just a moment, sir. I'll see."
Clunk. Will was put on hold. He cocked himself back in his swivel chair and sat that way for what seemed to be a very long time, although the red second hand on the office clock only revolved once. "He won't be there, and if he is, I'll eat my..." "Hello?" The voice was young, wearily curious, and unmistakably Cunningham's. Will Darnell felt a peculiar lift drop in his belly, but none of it showed in his voice. He was much too old for that. "Hi, Cunningham," he said. "Darnell."
"Will?"
"Yeah."
"What are you up to, Will?"
"How you doing, kid?"
"Won yesterday and drew today. Bullshit game. Couldn't seem to keep a mind on it. What's up?"
Yes, it was Cunningham. Him, without a doubt. Will, who would no more call someone without a cover story than he would go out without his skivvies on, said smoothly, "You got a pencil, kiddo?"
"Sure."
"There's an outfit on North Broad Street, United Auto Parts. You think you could go by there and see what they've got for tires?"
"Retreads?" Arnie asked.
"First lines."
"Sure, I can go by. I'm free tomorrow afternoon from noon until 3.
"That'll be fine. You ask for Roy Mustangara and mention my name."
"Spell that." Will spelled it. "That's all?"
"Yeah, except I hope you get your ass whooped."
"Fat chance," Cunningham said and laughed. Will told him goodbye and hung up. It was Cunningham, no doubt about that. Cunningham was in Philadelphia tonight, and Philadelphia was almost 300 miles away. Who could he have given an extra set of keys to?
The Gilder kid, sure, except the Gilder kid was in the hospital. His girl. But she didn't have a driver's license or even a permit. Arnie had said so. Someone else. There was no one else. Cunningham wasn't close to anyone else, except for Will himself, and Will knew damned well Cunningham had never given him a dupe set of keys.
Like magic.
Shit. Will leaned back in his chair again and lit another cigar. When it was going, and the neatly clipped-off end was in his ashtray, he looked up at the raftering smoke and thought it over. Nothing came. Cunningham was in Philly, and he had gone on the high school bus, but his car was gone. Jimmy Sykes had seen it pulling out, but Jimmy hadn't seen who was driving it. Now, just what did all of that mean? What did it add up to? Gradually, his mind turned into other channels. He thought of his own high school days, when he had had the lead part in the senior play. His part had been that of the minister who was driven to suicide by his lust for Sadie Thompson, the girl he had set out to save. He had brought down the house. His one moment of glory in a high school career that had been devoid of sporting or academic triumphs, and maybe the high point of his youth. His father had been a drunk, his mother a drudge, his one brother a deadbeat, with his own moment of glory coming somewhere in Germany. His only applause, the steady pounding of German 88s. He thought of his one girlfriend, a pallid blonde named Wanda Haskins, whose white cheeks had been splattered with freckles, which grew painfully profuse in the August sun. They almost surely would have been married. Wanda was one of four girls that Will Darnell had actually fucked. He excluded horrors from his count. She was surely the only one he had ever loved, always assuming there was such a thing. And, like the supernatural events he had sometimes heard about but never witnessed, he could doubt its existence but not disprove it. But her father had been in the army, and Wanda had been an army brat. At the age of 15, perhaps only a year before the mystic shift in the balance of power from the hands of the old into those of the young, she and her family had moved to Wichita, and that had been the end of that. There was a certain lipstick she had worn, and in that long-ago summer of 1934, it had tasted like fresh raspberries to a Will Darnell who was still quite slim and clear-eyed and ambitious and young. It had been a taste to make the left hand stray to the erect and enthusiastic root of the penis in the middle of the night. And even before Wanda Haskins consented, they had danced that sweet and special dance in Will Darnell's dreams. In his narrow child's bed that was too short for his growing legs, they had danced. And now, thinking of this dance, Will ceased to think and began to dream, and, ceasing to dream, began to dance again. He awakened from a sleep that had never really deepened solidly, some 3 hours later. He awoke to the sound of the big garage door rattling up, and the inside light over the door, no fluorescent, but a blaring 200-watt bulb, coming on. Will tilted his chair back down in a hurry. His shoes hit the mat under his desk, Bardol, written across it in raised rubber letters, and it was the shock of pins and needles in his feet, more than anything else, that brought him awake. Christine moved slowly across the garage toward stall 20 and slipped in. Will, hardly convinced even now that he was awake, watched her with a curious lack of excitement which perhaps only belongs to those summoned directly from their dreams. He sat upright behind his desk, ham-like arms planted on his dirty, doodled-upon blotter, and watched her. The engine raced once, twice. The bright new exhaust pipe shot blue smoke. Then the motor shut down. Will sat there, not moving. His door was shut, but there was an intercom always on between the office and the long barn-like garage area. It was the same intercom on which he had heard the beginnings of the Cunningham-Repperton title fight back in August. From the intercom speaker, he now heard the steady tick of metal as the engine cooled. He heard nothing else. No one got out of Christine, because there was no one in her to get out. He put stuff like that in an open file, because nothing really inexplicable had ever happened to him, except maybe something like that was happening now. He had seen her cross the cement to stall 20, the automatic door rattling shut against the cold December night behind her. And experts examining the case later could say, the witness had dozed and then fallen asleep, he admits that much, and that he was dreaming. What he claims to have seen was obviously nothing more or less than an extension of that dream, an outward stimulus causing a subjective range of spontaneous dream-oriented imagery. Yes, they could say that, just as Will could dream of dancing with 15-year-old Wanda Haskins. But the reality was a hard-headed man of 61. A man who had long since jettisoned any last romantic notions, and he had seen Cunningham's 58 glide across the garage empty, the steering wheel moving all by itself as the car slipped into her accustomed stall. He had seen the headlights go off, and he had heard the 8-cylinder engine as it died. Now, feeling oddly boneless, Will Darnell got up, hesitated, went to the door of his office, hesitated again, and then opened it. He walked out and moved down the ranks of slant-parked cars to stall 20. His footfalls echoed behind him, and then died out in a mystery. He stood beside the car with her rich two-tone body, red and white. The paint job was deep and clear and perfect, unmarred by the smallest chip or the slightest touch of rust. The glass was clear and unbroken, not marked by so much as a nick caused by a random flying pebble. The only sound now was the slow drip of melting snow from the front and rear bumpers. Will touched the hood. It was warm. He tried the driver's side door, and it opened freely. The smell that issued forth was the warm smell of new leather, new plastic, new chrome. Except that there seemed to be another, more unpleasant smell beneath it, an earthy smell. Will breathed deep, but could not place it. He thought briefly of old turnips in his father's basement vegetable bin, and his nose wrinkled. He leaned in. There were no keys in the ignition. The odometer read 52,107.8. Suddenly, the empty ignition slot set into the dashboard revolved, the black slit heeling over of its own accord past accessory to start. The hot engine caught at once and rumbled steadily, full of contented high-octane power. Will's heart staggered in his chest. His breath caught. Gasping and whooping noisily for breath, he hurried back to his office to find the spare aspirator in one of his desk drawers. His breath, thin and impotent, sounded like winter wind under an entryway door. His face was the color of old candle wax. His fingers caught in the loose flesh of his throat and pulled restlessly. Christine's engine turned off again. No sound now, but the tick and click of cooling metal. Will found his aspirator, plunged it deep into his throat, depressed the trigger, and inhaled. Little by little, the feeling that a wheelbarrow full of cinder blocks was sitting on his chest dissipated. He sat down in the swivel chair and listened gratefully to the sane and expected creak of protest from its springs. He covered his face momentarily with his fat hands. Nothing really inexplicable. Until now. He had seen it. Nothing had been driving that car. It had come in empty, smelling of something like rotting turnips. And even then, in spite of his dread, Will's mind began to turn, and he began wondering how he could put what he knew to his own advantage. 38. Breaking Connections. Well, mister, I want a yellow convertible, four-door DeVille, with a Continental spare and wire chrome wheels. I want power steering and power brakes. I want a powerful motor with a jet offtake. I want shortwave radio. I want TV and a phone, and you know I gotta talk to my baby when I'm riding along. Chuck Berry. The burned-out wreck of Buddy Repperton's Camaro was found late on Wednesday afternoon by a park ranger. An old lady who lived with her husband in the tiny town of Upper Squatuck had called the ranger station on the lake side of the park. She was badly afflicted with arthritis, and sometimes she couldn't sleep. Last night, she thought she had seen flames coming from near the park's south gate. At what time? She reckoned it to be around 10:15, because she had been watching the Tuesday night movie on CBS, and it hadn't been but half over. On Thursday, a news photo of the burned car appeared on the front page of the Libertyville Keystone, under a headline which read, Three Killed in Car Crash at Squatuck Hills State Park. A state police source was quoted as saying, Liquor was probably a factor, an officially opaque way of saying that the shattered remains of over half a dozen bottles of a juice and wine combination sold under the trade name Texas Driver had been found in the wreckage. The news struck particularly hard at Libertyville High School. The young always have the greatest difficulty accepting unpleasant intelligence of their own mortality. Perhaps the holiday season made it that much harder. Arnie Cunningham found himself terribly depressed by the news. Depressed and frightened. First Moochie, now Buddy, Richie Trelawney, and Bobby Stanton. Bobby Stanton, a dipshit little freshman Arnie had never even heard of. What had a dipshit little kid like that been doing with the likes of Buddy Repperton and Richie Trelawney anyway? Didn't he know that was like going into a den of tigers with nothing for protection but a squirt gun? He found it unaccountably hard to accept the grapevine version, which was simply that Buddy and his friends had gotten pretty well squiffed at the basketball game, had gone out cruising and drinking, and had come to a bad end. He couldn't quite lose the feeling that he was somehow involved. Lee had stopped talking to him since the argument. Arnie didn't call her, partly out of pride, partly out of shame, partly out of a wish that she would call him first and things could go back to what they had been before. Before what? His mind whispered. Well, before she almost choked to death in your car, for one thing. Before you tried to punch out the guy who saved her life. But she wanted him to sell Christine. And that was simply impossible, wasn't it? How could he do that after he had put so much time and effort and blood and, yes, it was true, even tears into it? It was an old rap, and he didn't want to think about it. The final bell rang on that seemingly endless Thursday, and he went out to the student parking lot, almost ran out, and nearly dived into Christine. He sat there behind the wheel and drew a long, shuddering breath, watching the first snowflakes of an afternoon flurry twist and skirl across the bright hood. He dug for his keys, pulled them out of his pocket, and started Christine up. The motor hummed confidently, and he pulled out, tires rolling and crunching over the packed snow. He would have to put snow tires on eventually, he supposed, but the truth was, Christine didn't seem to need them. She had the best traction of any car he had ever driven. He felt for the radio knob and turned on WDIL. Sheb Woolley was singing The Purple People Eater. That raised a smile on his face at last. Just being behind Christine's wheel, in control, made everything seem better. It made everything seem manageable. Hearing about Repperton and Trelawney and the little shitter stepping out that way had been a terrible shock, naturally, and after the hard feelings of the late summer and this fall, it was probably natural enough for him to feel a little guilty. But the simple truth was, he had been in Philly. He hadn't had anything to do with it. It was impossible. He had just been feeling low about things in general. Dennis was in the hospital. Lee was behaving stupidly as if his car had grown hands and jammed that piece of hamburger down her throat, for Christ's sake. And he had quit the chess club today. Maybe the worst part of that had been the way Mr. Slauson, the faculty advisor, had accepted his decision without even trying to change his mind. Arnie had given him a lot of guff about how little time he had these days and how he was simply going to have to cut back on some of his activities, and Mr. Slauson had simply nodded and said, "Okay, Arnie, we'll be right here in room 30 if you change your mind." Mr. Slauson had looked at him with his faded blue eyes that his thick glasses magnified to the size of repulsive boiled eggs, and there had been something in them. Was it reproach? Maybe it had been. But the guy hadn't even tried to persuade him to stay, that was the thing. He should have at least tried, because Arnie was the best the LHS chess club had to offer, and Slauson knew it. If he had tried, maybe Arnie would have changed his mind. The truth was, he did have a little more time now that Christine was... What? Well, fixed up again. If Mr. Slauson had said something like, "Hey, Arnie, don't be so rash. Let's think this over. We could really use you." If Mr. Slauson had said something like that, why, he might have reconsidered. But not Slauson. "Just we'll be right here in room 30 if you change your mind," and blah, blah, and yak, yak. What a fucking shitter, just like the rest of them. It wasn't his fault that LHS had been knocked out in the semifinal round. He had won four games before that and would have won in the finals if he had gotten a chance. It was those two shitters, Barry Quelson and Mike Hicks, that had lost it for them. Both of them played chess as if maybe they thought Rui Lopez was some new kind of soft drink or something. He stripped the wrapper and the foil from a stick of gum, folded the gum into his mouth, balled the wrapper, and flicked it into the litter bag hanging from Christine's ashtray with neat accuracy. "Right up the little tramp's ass," he muttered, and then grinned. It was a hard, spitless grin. Above it, his eyes moved restlessly from side to side, looking mistrustfully out at a world full of crazy drivers and stupid pedestrians and general idiocy. Arnie cruised aimlessly around Libertyville, his thoughts continuing to run on in this softly paranoid and bitterly comforting fashion. The radio spilled out a steady flood of golden oldies, and today all of them seemed to be instrumentals. Rebel Rouser, Wild Weekend, Telstar, Sandy Nelson's jungle-driven Teen Beat, and Rumble by Link Ray, the greatest of them all. His back nagged, but in a low key. The flurry intensified briefly to a dark gray cloud of snow. He popped on his headlights, and just as quickly the snow tapered off and the clouds broke, spilling through bars of remote and coldly beautiful late afternoon winter sun. He cruised. He came out of his thoughts, which now were that Repperton had maybe come to a perfectly fitting end after all, and was shocked to realize that it was nearly quarter of six and dark. Gino's Pizza was coming up on the left, the little green neon shamrocks shimmering in the dark. Arnie pulled over to the curb and got out. He started across the street, then realized he had left his keys in Christine's ignition. He leaned in to get them, and suddenly the smell assaulted him. The smell Lee had told him about, the smell he had denied, it was here now, as if it had come out when he left the car. A high, rotten, meaty smell that made his eyes water and his throat close. He snatched the keys and stood back, trembling, looking at Christine with something like horror.
Arnie, there was a smell. A horrible, rotten smell. You know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't have the slightest idea. You're imagining things. But if she was, so was he. Arnie turned suddenly and ran across the street to Gino's as if the devil was on his tail. Inside, he ordered a pizza he didn't really want, changed some quarters for dimes, and slipped into the telephone booth beside the juke. It was thumping some current tune Arnie had never heard before. He called home first. His father answered, his voice oddly toneless. Arnie had never heard Michael's voice quite that way before, and his unease deepened. His father sounded like Mr. Slauson. This Thursday afternoon and evening were taking on the maroon tones of nightmare. Beyond the glass walls of the booth, strange faces drifted dreamily past, like untethered balloons on which someone had crudely drawn human faces. God at work with a magic marker. Shitters, he thought disjointedly. All a bunch of shitters.
Hello, Dad, he said uncertainly. Look, I kind of lost track of the time here. I'm sorry.
That's all right, Michael said. His voice was almost a drone, and Arnie felt his unease deepen into something like fright. Where are you, the garage?
No, Gino's. Gino's Pizza. Dad, are you okay? You sound funny.
I'm fine, Michael said. Just scraped your dinner down the garbage disposal. Your mother's upstairs crying again, and you're having a pizza. I'm fine. Enjoying your car, Arnie? Arnie's throat worked, but no sound came out.
Dad, he managed finally, I don't think that's very fair.
I don't think I'm very interested anymore in what you think is fair and what you don't think is fair, Michael said. You had some justification for your behavior at first, perhaps, but in the last month or so you've turned into someone I don't understand at all. And something is going on that I understand even less. Your mother doesn't understand it either, but she senses it, and it's hurting her very badly. I know she brought part of the hurt on herself, but I doubt if that changes the quality of the pain.
Dad, I just lost track of the time, Arnie cried. Stop making such a big thing out of it.
Were you driving around?
Yes, but...
I notice that's when it usually happens, Michael said. Will you be home tonight?
Yes, early, Arnie said. He wet his lips.
I just want to go by the garage. I have some information Will asked me to get while I was in Philly. I'm not very interested in that either, pardon me, Michael said. His voice was still polite, chillingly disconnected.
Oh,
Arnie said in a very small voice. He was very scared now, almost trembling. Arnie?
What?
Arnie nearly whispered. What is going on?
I don't know what you mean.
Please, that detective came by to see me at my office. He was after Regina as well. He upset her very badly. I don't think he meant to, but...
What was it this time? Arnie asked fiercely. That fucker, what was it this time, huh?
You'll what?
Nothing.
He swallowed something that tasted like a lump of dust.
What was it this time?
Repperton, his father said. Repperton and those two other boys. What did you think it was? The geopolitical situation in Brazil?
What happened to Repperton was an accident, Arnie said. Why did he want to talk to you and Mom about something that was an accident, for Christ's sake?
I don't know. Michael Cunningham paused. Do you?
How would I? Arnie yelled. I was in Philadelphia. How would I know anything about it? I was playing chess, not anything else, he finished lamely.
One more time, Michael Cunningham said. Is something going on, Arnie? He thought of the smell, the high, rotting stink. Lee choking, digging at her throat, turning blue. He had tried to thump her on the back because that's what you did when someone was choking. There was no such thing as a Heimlich maneuver because it hadn't been invented yet. And besides, this was how it was supposed to end, only not in the car, beside the road, in his arms. He closed his eyes and the whole world seemed to tilt and swirl sickly. Arnie?
There is nothing going on,
he said through clenched teeth and without opening his eyes. Nothing but a lot of people who are on my case because I finally got something of my own and did it all by myself.
All right, his father said, his lackluster voice once more terribly reminiscent of Mr. Slauson's. If you want to talk about it, I'm here. I always have been, although I didn't always make that as clear as I should have. Be sure to kiss your mother when you come in, Arnie.
Yeah, I will. Listen, my...
Click. He stood in the booth, listening stupidly to the sound of nothing at all. His father was gone. There wasn't even a dial tone because it was a dumb fucking phone booth. He dug into his pocket and spread his change out on the little metal shelf where he could look at it. He picked up a dime, almost dropped it, and at last got it into the slot. He felt sick and overheated. He felt as if he had been very efficiently disowned. He dialed Lee's number from memory. Mrs. Cabot picked the phone up and recognized his voice immediately. Her pleasant and rather sexy, "Come hither, thou fascinating stranger," phone voice became instantly hard. Arnie had had his last chance with her, that voice said, and he had blown it. "She doesn't want to talk to you, and she doesn't want to see you," she said. "Mrs. Cabot, please, if I could just..."
"I think you've done enough," Mrs. Cabot said coolly. "She came in crying the other night, and she's been crying off and on ever since. She had some sort of an experience with you the last time you and she went out, and I only pray it wasn't what I thought it was. Arnie felt hysterical laughter bubbling up inside him. Lee had almost choked to death on a hamburger, and her mother was afraid Arnie had tried to rape her.
"Mrs. Cabot, I have to talk to her."
"I'm afraid not." He tried to think of something else to say, some way to get past the dragon at the gate. He felt a little like a Fuller brush salesman trying to get in to see the lady of the house. His tongue wouldn't move. He would have made a lousy salesman. There was going to be that hard click, and then smooth silence again. Then he heard the telephone change hands. Mrs. Cabot said something in sharp protest, and Lee said something back. It was too muffled for him to catch. Then Lee's voice said, "Arnie?"
"Hi," he said.
"Lee, I just wanted to call and tell you how sorry I was about..."
"Yes," Lee said. "I know you were, and I accept your apology, Arnie, but I won't... I can't go out with you anymore, unless things change."
"Ask me something easy," he whispered.
"That's all I..." Her voice sharpened, moved slightly away from the telephone. "Mom, please stop hanging over me."
Her mother said something that sounded disgruntled. There was a pause, and then Lee's voice again, low.
"That's all I can say, Arnie. I know how crazy it sounds, but I still think your car tried to kill me the other night. I don't know how something like that could be, but no matter how I work it over in my mind, it comes out seeming that that was how it was. I know that's how it was. It's got you, doesn't it?"
"Lee, if you'll pardon my French, that's pretty fucking stupid. It's a car. Can you spell that? C-A-R, car. There's nothing..."
"Yes," she said, and now her voice was wavering toward tears. "It's got you. She's got you, and I guess nobody can get you free except you."
His back suddenly awoke and began to throb, sending pain out in a sickish radiation that seemed to echo and amplify in his head.
"Isn't that the truth of it, Arnie?"
He didn't, couldn't answer.
"Get rid of it," Lee said. "Please. I read about that Repperton boy in the paper this morning, and..."
"What's that got to do with anything?" Arnie croaked, and for the second time, "That was an accident."
"I don't know what it was. Maybe I don't want to know. But it isn't us I'm worried about anymore. It's you, Arnie. I'm scared for you. You ought to... No, you have to get rid of it."
Arnie whispered, "Just say you won't dump me, Lee, okay?" Now she was even closer to crying, or perhaps she was already doing it.
"Promise me, Arnie. You have to promise me, and then you have to do it. Then we can see. Promise me you'll get rid of that car. It's all I want from you, nothing else."
He closed his eyes and saw Lee walking home from school, and a block down, idling at the curb, was Christine, waiting for her. He opened his eyes quickly, as if he had seen a fiend in a dark room.
"I can't do that," he said.
"Then we don't have much to talk about, do we?"
"Yes, yes, we do. We..."
"No. Goodbye, Arnie. I'll see you in school."
"Lee, wait!"
Click, and dead, smooth silence. A moment of nearly total rage came over him. He had a sudden deadly impulse to swing the black phone receiver around and around his head like an Argentinian bolas,
shattering the glass in this goddamn torture chamber of a telephone booth. They had run out on him, all of them. Rats deserting a sinking ship.
End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.